I'd like to begin, obviously, by thanking the organisers for inviting me to participate in this lovely workshop. It's been a little, the last few days have been a little bit bittersweet for me because I've not been able to be present physically. And I can tell by the questions and by the discussions, I can half hear what a fantastic time everybody's having. And I'm very sad not to be able to meet with you. On the other hand, I'm also extremely grateful to be given any kind of opportunity at all. I do recognise the flexibility that you've shown in opening up this slot for me to give my talk. I'm going to be talking about the two-person Turing, dimensional Turing model, so let me just straight away get on with it. I'm a particle physicist by background. We use quantum field theory as our language. And most of the quantum field theories that are useful in particle physics are weakly interacting at short distances. And that means that we have a reasonable idea of how to do calculations with them. We've evolved over many decades, pretty good techniques, both analytical and more recently numerical to do this. But logically, that's not the only possibility for a quantum field theory. And we've heard this week from many examples in condensed matter physics where quantum field theories can be strongly interacting. And the question is our understanding of strongly interacting field theories as robust? Can we have the same kind of theoretical technical control? So what I'm really talking about is how can we understand critical behavior in quantum field theory? That's what I'm going to be talking about today. And I'm going to be doing that in the context of a theory of fermions in 2+1 dimensions. I'm going to argue that in order to get the physics right at this quantum critical point, the crucial aspect is to capture relevant global symmetries with whatever technique we're using. I'm going to be using numerical lattice field theory. I'm going to present results, which I think will, in the context of the talks, many talks we've heard, is not going to be particularly surprising, which are going to show that different lattice discretizations are going to produce different predictions for the critical properties of these theories. And then finally, if there's time, I'd like to present new results recently obtained for the spectrum of the Turing model. So let's leap straight in. This is what I mean by the Turing model. It's a theory of relativistic fermions where the fermions self-interact by a contact interaction, that's a fourth fermion interaction, between two conserved currents. So without going into too much detail, I just want to note that I will be assuming that the spinner fields for my relativistic fermions are four component objects, and they're acted on by four dimensional Dirac matrices. The fact that the interaction is between conserved currents has the physical consequence that the heuristic for understanding interactions is that like charges repel, opposite charges attract, just like electrodynamics. There's some useful definitions at the bottom of the screen. You'll notice because I'm using 4x4 Dirac matrices, I do in fact have a gamma 5 matrix, which you can see somewhere towards the lower right of the screen. Now, there are many applications of such relativistic theories in condensed matter physics. Michael named a few in his talk, and I think I'm naming pretty much the same ones. I'm not going to go through any of this in detail, just to note that theories of relativistic fermions crop up when we're talking about theories of D-wave superconductivity, perhaps in the spin liquid phase of antiferromagnets, as the surface states of topological insulators. And of course, perhaps the most celebrated example is graphene, electron structure of graphene. And the kind of central thing which could happen in a strongly interacting theory of relativistic fermions is represented by these figures here. We can consider that the fact that the sort of Fock vacuum, that's the state of just freely propagating fermions, could actually be disrupted if the interactions between particles and antiparticles, or equivalently particles and holes, actually condense in pairs to form what we call a bilinear condensate. We've seen already several times, I think, in the workshop, that the consequence of this is that the the Dirac a gap opens up at the Dirac cone, and this results in a dynamically generated mass gap. In particle physics, we believe this is the origin behind chiral symmetry breaking and QCD, this kind of mechanism. I was kind of drawn into this 2+1 dimensional world by reading a paper by Damson a few years ago, who said that if such a phenomenon occurred in graphene, the universal properties around that critical point could well have a very important consequences for the low energy electronic excitations of graphene, and that might even have technological consequences. But from a field theorist perspective, if there is a quantum critical point and it's a continuous phase transition, there'll be a diverging correlation length, and that will mean that there's the possibility of defining a new strongly interacting quantum field theory in 2+1 dimensions there. A priori, it turns out that's going to be quite a challenge for theory because there are no small dimensionless parameters in play for this particular system with the interaction between conserved currents. So I would argue, I have argued, that the Turing model is the simplest model of fermions where you absolutely have to approach it by a non-perturbative technique such as numerical simulation, numerical Monte Carlo simulation using lattice field theory. Before I plunge in, let me just review the symmetries that are in play at this in 2+1 dimensions. So this is going to, the symmetries are broken when the gap forms. So this is not an example of symmetric mass generation. It's a much more orthodox. The point is that if I write down the action for four component fermions, then there are not one, but two Dirac matrices which anti-commute with the kinetic operator. And that is gamma 5, which we're used to, but also gamma 3, the third gamma matrix. And that means that the set of symmetry rotations which I can impose on the fermion fields is quite a rich one. There are four independent rotations, and between them they generate a U2N global symmetry in general. Now, two of those rotations stop being symmetries in the presence of a mass term, so that I can break the symmetry either explicitly by adding a mass or spontaneously by some kind of gapping, and the pattern of symmetry breaking is U2N goes to UN cross UN, and that's what characterizes symmetry breaking in the Turing model. It's important to specify that the mass term that I'm talking about is invariant under parity. That's another particular symmetry. A discrete symmetry, which is represented in many Hamiltonian systems. Because the symmetry is rich, it turns out that there are physically equivalent symmetries in the mass terms for the continuum model. I can write down the traditional looking mass term, M psi bar psi, that's Hermitian, but there are also two anti-Hermitian terms. This is the Euclidean metric. A psi bar gamma 3 psi and a psi bar gamma 5 psi. And they're sometimes called twisted mass terms. They're sometimes called Kekulé mass terms, since they correspond to a particular pattern of symmetry breaking in honeycomb systems. There's one further mass term you might consider writing down with both a gamma 3 and a gamma 5 in. That's sometimes called the Haldane mass. That's not parity invariant, and I won't be discussing it further today. So, how can we study this kind of system using lattice field theory? The first attempts, which date now for over 20 years, use what we heard about this morning from Simon. They use a fermion formulation called staggered fermions. These are the staggered fermions. Simon gave them a xi letter. I'm calling them chi in this slide, and that's what the action looks like. The four fermion interaction has been replaced by an interaction with a vector auxiliary field, which I've called a mu. It lives on the link which connects two lattice sites, and it only occurs to quadratic order. So you can integrate out the a field. It's a simple Gaussian integration. And if you did that, you would recover an interaction term with a two chi bars and two chis living across a link. One important factor is that those A fields look a little bit like gauge fields. And you could think of one plus or minus I times A as being a little bit like a link field, which we're used to in lattice gauge theory. But it's unlike lattice gauge theory, that link field is not unitary because it's one plus IA, it's what it says it is. Now, the thing is with staggered fermions, and this is what a little bit very similar to what Simon was telling you this morning, staggered fermions have a different pattern of symmetry breaking in the presence of a mass or in presence of a gap generation. The bare symmetry of staggered fermions is UN cross UN, and that breaks to UN by a mass term. So it's a different pattern to the continuum tiering model defined with Dirac fermions. However, we do believe that in a weak coupling continuum limit, as Simon said, that the expected continuum pattern of U2NF is eventually recovered. The relationship between NF and the number of staggered species is given there. NF is equal to 2N. And this is all a result of what's very familiar in lattice gauge theory. It's called fermion doubling. As Simon hinted this morning, we can really only hope that that would happen in a theory defined at weak coupling, where there's no such expectation at a general strongly coupled fixed point or at a quantum critical point. And that's going to be important in what follows. Nonetheless, if you press on, and these are as we did over many years, it is possible to simulate this model get the phase diagram I've shown here. It's a phase diagram where the horizontal axis is the inverse coupling strength and the vertical axis is the number of flavors. And there is indeed a separation into two different phases, a symmetric phase at top right, a broken phase, and an insulating phase at bottom left. And that insulating phase appears to exist for all values of NF smaller than a critical NF, which we estimate from Monte Carlo simulation to be about just over 3. So the critical number of flavors for the existence of a symmetry break, a gap generating symmetry breaking transition in the lattice tiering model with staggered fermions is just over 3 flavors. If you want to count it in terms of continuum degrees of freedom, it's just over 6, so it's between 6 and 7. Now, I was very happy with that result, but I was shaken a bit when a few years later, Shailesh and his collaborator, Annie Lee, reproduced the predictions for the minimal Turing model using a bag algorithm. A bag algorithm is able to do simulations directly in the massless limit. So it's a very efficient way of getting critical information. I was very pleased that Shailesh managed to reproduce our results for the Turing model, but I was dismayed when a few months later, he produced near identical exponent estimates for the U1 Grossnever model. Now, in continuum field theory, the Turing model and the U1 Grossnever model are completely different. They have very different expansions in 1 over n. In the Turing model, symmetry breaking only occurs for n smaller than a critical number, which we've estimated to be about 7. Whereas for the Grossnever model, we expect symmetry breaking for all values of NF in effect, because it's well described in a 1 over n expansion. And Shailesh's explanation for this is a very plausible one. If you actually forget about continuum field theory and write down the model in terms of the staggered fields, the Turing model and the Grossmer model look very, very similar. They only differ by the absence of a body diagonal coupling between staggered fields in the Turing case. So what I took from this is that the staggered fermions that I used for many years and loved, incidentally, were not reproducing the expected distinction between what I think of as probably two distinct field theories. And I think the problem is with the staggered fermions. My conclusion was we needed better lattice fermions. What do I mean by better? I mean fermions which can actually reproduce or in some sense capture the U2N symmetry, which is the characteristic symmetry of Dirac fermions in 2+1 dimensions. So the method I've adopted is one which has come to, which has directly come to us from lattice QCD. It's called domain wall fermions. And the idea here is that you actually simulate a theory with an extra dimension. You introduce a fictitious new dimension, which I've labeled as the third direction in this talk. And the lattice in that third direction has two open boundary conditions. So the basic idea is that as you increase the distance between those two ends, they're called domain walls, then there are zero modes of the fermion operator, which have become increasingly well localized on those walls. And they're also eigenmodes of the gamma 3 Dirac matrix. And the idea is that physical the physical fields living in 2+1 dimensions, the target theory, can be defined in terms of projection operators, in terms of the 2+1+1 dimensional fields defined on those domain walls by the two equations that are written on the bottom of this slide. And that's an assumption. It's telling us that there's a lot of bulk physics going on between the walls, which somehow I can decouple. And the physics that I want, describing U2N symmetric physics, is kind of happening on those two walls. And if I want to introduce a mass term or a gapping term, that mass term will actually be coupling the modes along the walls. So that's what's represented by the blue arrow on that diagram. What I've presented to you there is very much a bottom-up view, where it's a very physically motivated view of what's going on with domain wall fermions. And as has already been observed, there's a lot of similarities, a lot of congruences with what we now know about edge states in say, topological insulators. Those modes, we want the modes to carry the U2N invariant physics. We want the modes moving in the bulk not to contribute. And in fact, it's possible to do that with a certain amount of cunning involving the strength of the domain wall height, and assuming as well that the gauge fields or the boson fields which the fermions interact with are sufficiently smooth. There is another way of thinking about domain wall physics, and this was very much brought to the fore in Rajamani's talk earlier this week. And one way of thinking about this, the way I'm going to present it, starts with the symmetries. One way of expressing the U2N symmetry which we want is via this set of anti-commutation and commutation relations between the fermion operator D and the various generators of the U2N symmetry. There's quite a profound theorem in lattice field theory, which says that there is no regular lattice discretization which is capable of respecting those relations while simultaneously describing unitary local dynamics of a single species. That's the well-known Nielsen-Linnemeyer theorem. And in fact, then there are renormalization group arguments which say that the best we can hope to get is some modified relations on the bottom, and these are now known as these are called the Ginz-Park-Wilson relations. They're almost the same, and in fact, you can convince yourself they ought to be the same because the right-hand side of those two anti-commutators are formally or notionally of the same order as the lattice spacing. So they should, if the fields are smooth and the dynamics is local enough, the right-hand sides of those equations should vanish in the long wavelength limit, and we should get a recover dynamics which obeys the U2N symmetry we want. And the operator, which the approach which Rajamani showed you, there is actually a 2+1 dimensional operator which can be constructed, which manifestly obeys those symmetries. It's the overlap operator. Domain wall fermions are a regularization of the overlap operator. The domain wall fermions are really a sort of cheap way of describing them is that they're local in 2+1+1 dimensions. That makes them easy to code. They're not manifestly local in 2+1 dimensions where we want to apply them. So we have to check that numerically. But the point that it can actually be proved algebraically that in the limit where the distance between the domain walls becomes large enough, the domain wall fermion operator recovers the overlap operator, which Rajamani described for us earlier this week. Before I leap in and start showing you lots of results, just again, cover a couple of formulational issues. One is that the interaction between the fermions and the auxiliary bosons, the AMU fields, that interaction actually takes place throughout the bulk. So although the AMU field is a three-dimensional field, it actually interacts with four-dimensional fermions all the way throughout the whole space between the two walls. And that's known to correspond to the coupling of the auxiliary field to a conserved fermion current, which is what we want. The consequence of that is that the fermion operator, again, is proportional to 1+IAMU, not to e to the IAMU. So the link variables, unlike in a gauge theory, are non-compact and non-unitary. There's also a technical point here, which I think I'll skip. Okay. So let me come on to some results. Initially, I'm going to focus attention on the symmetry breaking order parameter. For technical reasons, it turns out to be most convenient to look at the order parameter, the bilinear condensate psi bar gamma 3 psi. Remember, in a U2N symmetric theory, that's equivalent to psi bar psi. These first results are taken with a system with a fixed separation of 16 between the domain walls. The three different colors, blue, green, and red, correspond to zero flavors, one flavor, and two flavors. And you can see that as the number of flavors increases, the signal for a bilinear condensate gets very small. So it looks like the bilinear condensate is large in the quenched theory with n equals zero. It looks like it's not very big at all for two flavors. And the one flavor case looks to be the interesting one. The hierarchy, in other words, is consistent with a critical number of flavors, which could be between one and two. But it's impossible to say anything just from this data, because we really need to show that we can achieve the large LS limit, because that's where the U2N symmetry is lying. So in other words, to really describe and settle the issue of symmetry breaking, we need to attempt to go to the large LS limit. And that turns out to be quite challenging numerically. So here are two plots which show you this. In the top left-hand plot, you can see the measurement for the bilinear condensate as a function of LS, and you can see it varies I've got data here from values of LS up to 80. And you can see that there's quite a significant dependence on LS. In fact, we model that dependence by some kind of exponential. You can see the equation at the top, which says that the signal that we measure at finite LS approaches the infinite LS limit with an exponential. The decay rate is characterized by a quantity delta. That delta, however, is very coupling dependent. The results I'm showing you here are at weak coupling. If I go to strong coupling, the LS goes to infinity extrapolation is much, much harder to control. If I try to show, if I plot the value of the decay constant delta, it falls into roughly two families. At weak coupling, delta is pretty flat and insensitive to the fermion mass, But if I go into the strong coupling regime, the delta actually tends to get smaller and smaller as I go towards the massless limit. Delta getting small means it costs me a lot of effort to get to the large LS limit. And that's the big, proved to be the big problem with this program. You have to go to very, very large values of LS. I won't go through all of the details on this plot, which kind of quantifies the problem, except to say that the results I'm showing you, well, the numbers here are quoted for 16 cubed times 48 lattice, where we're requiring typically 20,000 iterations of our conjugate gradient solver for each Hamiltonian trajectory. It gets much worse than that when you go up to LS equals 80. It's been a long and painful road, actually requiring significant computer resources. I'll just show you the result. What I'm plotting here is again the order parameter data as a function of the coupling constant. The coupling constant is getting weaker as we go towards the right. Different colored symbols correspond to different mass values. Again, because of the nature of the interaction, it's impossible to obtain data for the order parameter directly in the massless limit, which is ideally where you'd like it. So our approach to studying the critical properties is to collect lots of data at different values of m and then fit it empirically to a renormalization group-inspired equation of state, where the fit parameters are the critical coupling, G sub C, and delta and beta, which are critical exponents. This fit, you can see the error, some of the error bars look rather large. That's because we're fitting data which has been extrapolated from maybe six different values of LS to the LS goes to infinity limit. So there's quite a lot of analysis hiding under the hood here, which I don't really have time to go into today. But the good news, I think it's good news, is that the fit is pretty good, and it suggests that there is in fact a quantum critical point existing for n equals one, and that the critical coupling is between, or the inverse coupling is between 0.25 and 0.3. So here are some preliminary results. We haven't yet published these full results. We have a most recent data set, including LS equals 80, and also including data on both sides of the critical coupling. But we're getting a critical coupling of about 2.28, and the exponents delta just greater than 4, beta, the magnetic exponent, of about 0.3. In sort of more orthodox approach to critical exponents from finite volume scaling, it's more usual, as we've seen today, to quote results for the exponents nu and eta. So I can extract those exponents assuming hyperscaling holds. Nu and eta turn out to be 0.5 and 0.16 here. Also, the other big result is at the top right, that the I've also studied a two-flavor theory and not found any evidence for symmetry breaking. So the prediction from these simulations is that the critical number of flavors lies between 1 and 2. And I want to contrast that with those old results from 1997 from the staggered fermions, which I've now learned to call Dirac, Kähler-Dirac fermions, as Simon went through this morning. I'll remind you that we had a critical number of flavors there between 3 and 4 and rather different critical exponents. So on the face of it, it looks like if we're simulating Dirac fermions with these Demaimore fermions, they're giving a very different answer to a simulation of Kähler-Dirac fermions using the staggered lattice approach. There's something in the chat. Is that a question? 5 minutes till questions. That's code for get a move on. Okay. I want to show you now some results for the Turing model spectrum. It's only when you, we need this for two reasons. One is that in order to set a scale and basically quantitatively understand what's going on at the critical point, to identify a physical correlation length, we're going to need spectral quantities. In other words, we're going to need some mass fitting. Also, we want to understand, I think, not just the ground state of the system, but also its excitations in order to bring it to life. So just to look at, we've looked at basically two different correlations. We've looked at mesons, those are bound states of a fermion and an antifermion in the spin zero sector, and we've looked at the fermion itself, the fermion quasiparticle itself. In the meson sector, we expect there to be two Goldstones, one positive parity, one negative parity, and we expect there to be two non-Goldstones, again, one of either parity. In fact, I'm not going to give you any results today for the positive parity non-Goldstone because it requires calculation of disconnected diagrams, and that's just, we still don't have the statistics to make that feasible. These are what the correlators look like in both the symmetric phase and the broken phase. Black is the pseudoscalar Goldstone, blue is the scalar Goldstone, and green is the non-Goldstone, red is the fermion. Okay, I'll go through it rather quickly. It turns out that with these domain wall fermions formulations that we're using, decay over the first five time slices is actually dominated by an artifact due to an unphysical branch cut. So you can't get sensible answers unless you go to a long time extent. We've gone to 48 in these particular simulations. The other thing I'd like to point out is that we're plotting on a log-log scale here, but if you look closely at those curves, they're not actually particularly good straight lines, particularly in the symmetric phase. That's a sign that the Euclidean decay is not a pure exponential, which translates into the statement that the spectral function isn't a simple pole. The other thing to notice is that the quasi-particle, the fermion propagator, is not symmetric under time inversion. And although it looks like we have a decent signal in the symmetric phase, it gets extremely noisy in the broken phase. Okay, well, here's the preliminary spectrum. Well, it turns out that the Goldstone degrees, the Goldstone masses of both parities, they agree with each other, which is good, despite the fact that the correlation functions look rather different. They give us very similar looking masses. And in fact, the spectrum's rather flat. But remember, this spectrum is being presented here in lattice units, not in physical units. And we expect the lattice spacing to be getting very small in the critical region around 0.28. So these are not physical masses, these are lattice masses. The non-Goldstone, the green points, are actually all over the place. They're not very well tied down at this point. The fermion mass, very weak coupling, the fermion mass is roughly half the Goldstone mass. In other words, the Goldstone meson is a weakly coupled bound state of a fermion antifermion, but it's becoming far heavier as we go into the broken phase. Interesting thing here is that I did the same job for staggered fermions over 20 years ago. I got a rather similar looking plot. So again, you can see here the Goldstone are the squares. They show a rather flat spectrum across the phase transition, whereas the non-Goldstone and the fermion mass are both rising quite sharply as you go from the weakly coupled phase into the strongly coupled phase. I'd also like to talk about the fermion propagator, because we now have results for the fermion propagator in the masses limit. This gives us access to another critical exponent, eta sub psi, which we haven't yet been able to source in any other way. We have a kind of straw man model for what to expect from this propagator, assuming that the correlator looks something like the expression we've got. It introduces a scale mu, which acts like an inverse correlation length, but it's not related to a particle pole. And in fact, what you can show, or what you can argue, is that at very short distances, we can see the propagator decaying, as you might expect, near a fixed point in a conformal way, with the power of the decay given by the fermion anomalous dimension. But at large distances, once our distance is much larger than the correlation length, that kind of crosses over into a 1 over x squared behavior. Here are our results for three different couplings. Beta of 0.36 is very weak, down to beta of 0.28, the red points, which are almost at the critical point. And the blue points are great because they're consistent with a 1 over x squared behavior, which we kind of anticipated. In other words, this is consistent with that algebraic decay. It certainly isn't the flat decay that you expect from free massless fermions. It's certainly not exponential decay. And you could argue it's what you might expect if the correlation length was still quite short, because we're a long way from the critical point. The red points, data is still accumulating. Looks like it's going as 1 over x cubed. So it could be algebraic, but it's inconsistent with kind of theoretical expectations for a unitary theory that eta should be between 0 and 1. So I would say this is really work in progress. We need to think and perhaps get better statistics before we come back. It's just too soon to translate these results into a prediction of eta psi. The big challenge that we face throughout is getting to the large LS limit where we think the U2N symmetry wants to be. Throughout, we've been using the simplest kind of vanilla form of domain wall fermions, which uses something called the Shamir kernel. In fact, what Rajamani was showing us earlier was using something called the Wilson kernel, which is slightly more involved to code in terms of domain wall fermions. It's slightly more expensive to calculate, but actually, we believe gives a significant improvement in the recovery of the symmetry, the Ginzburg-Wilson symmetry we want, as you make LS large. We have some data here, which I'll just gloss over. Let me just show you that these, again, are very preliminary results, obtained by my collaborator, Jude Worthy. So these are, again, equation of state plots, but this time, instead of LS equals 80, these are obtained with LS of 28 and LS of 36. They're giving more or less compatible results. Surprisingly, they show a very, very similar prediction for the critical beta of around about 0.28. So it looks like we could get very, very similar results, possibly with a lot less computer effort, by going from the Shamir kernel to the Wilson kernel. That's the good news. The bad news is that when you use this technique to fit the critical exponents, they're turning out to be very different from the Shamir values. The Shamir values are written down there, the ones I showed you earlier, but the Wilson kernel is getting far smaller values of delta, around about 2.5, and the beta value is much larger, closer to 0.75. So that's a worry, because really Shamir and Wilson kernels should be two different regularizations of the same continuum theory with the same symmetries. So you would expect them to predict compatible exponent estimates. So again, a lot more work and analysis and perhaps a bit more thought is going to be needed before we say anything. So that's me done. The most important thing, I think, is to acknowledge my collaborators, Michele Messiti and Jude Worthy, are both based at Swansea University. Johan Osmeyer, you've all met. He's based at Liverpool University. And here's the outcome. We claim that we found a new quantum critical point for Dirac fermions in 2+1 dimensions. It's distinct from the quantum critical point found couple of decades ago with staggered fermions. However, unfortunately, it also appears to be distinct from the quantum critical point found with yet another U2N invariant way of formulating fermions called the slack derivative, which has been pursued by the Jena group. So I have some thoughts about that, but it's important to acknowledge that there are different opinions on the market. We're just beginning a foray into the world of spectroscopy. We'd like to confirm the Goldstone and non-Goldstone nature of the various spin zero bound states. We'd like to understand the critical fermion propagators better and hence access the critical exponent eta sub psi. And it may well be that the next round of simulations, we will try to implement the Wilson kernel DWF as a means of getting to the large LS limit, the U2N invariant limit we need with far less computer effort. So thanks very much for listening.
Yeah, thank you very much, Simon. I think we still have time for a couple of questions. So we'll start with Lucas here.
Hello, Simon. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, perfectly, Lucas. Yeah.
So my question is, very long ago, I mean, I guess you have shown that Turing model in the large N limit has a UV completion, right?
Yes.
And the question basically is, can you access this UV completion within the lattice formulations?
I don't know how you do that. I mean, naively, yes, I could simply do a simulation with large, I believe, well, no, okay. What, when you, I didn't use, I don't think UV completion had been invented when I thought about this. The statement was that the Turing model is the 1 over n expansion is renormalizable. And in fact, the 1 over n corrections to the Turing model are order by order the same as those of large n QED3. So that means that I believe the theory exists. But what we're really looking at now is the physics of small n, where the 1 over n expansion is somehow breaking down and not giving the correct predictions.
Yeah, I get that point. My question basically is, if you go to large n, could it be that there is this fixed point, say at infinite coupling or so? Can you access some continuum limit at large coupling?
Right. That's not the way I think about it, which is not to say it's not the right way to. It's, I'm very much influenced by the work of Yamawaki and Sugiura, and they wrote a couple of papers which you probably know very well, where they made definite predictions. There is a critical number, flavor number. And of course, all non-perturbative attempts to predict this number get different answers. So I think you're saying is it possible that the critical number of flavors is infinite? Is that what you're saying?
Basically, my question is there a fixed point at large n?
Ah, yeah, I see. I don't know. I don't think I associate fixed points with phase transitions because those are what I can see on my computer. So it's difficult for me to answer. I'm not sure I have a sensible answer. I wish I was there with you and we could talk about this.
Thank you.
Okay. Rajamani's next.
Hi, Simon. My question is two related questions. I'll ask them together. The fact that you see that the largest limit, LS limit, is low, I suspect is because there are very small eigenvalues of the kernel, which might be due to monopole-like things. Do you know if you tried the compact version, it might look different?
Yeah. In fact, we have done that, and one of our papers shows results. If you replace the non, and I did try and hint at this, if you replace the non-compact links which define our model with compact degrees of freedom, everything improves: the localization of the length of the operator, the recovery of the Ginzburg-Wilson symmetry. Everything looks better, and my feeling there is, yes, that could well be that could well be an interesting model, but is it the Turing model? The reason that we have, the reason that I have those non-compact links is that I want the coupling between the psi bar psi and A to be linear, so that when I integrate out the A field, I get four fermion terms and nothing else. If I have compact degrees of freedom, then I get basic ballpoint interactions. So either those extra interactions are not relevant, which is quite possible, and that I get the same Turing physics, and I just don't know the answer to that because I've never looked at it, or those extra higher point interactions are relevant, in which case it's a different model, I think.
Thank you.
But I certainly would not, as you probably know, I wouldn't discourage anybody from going away and looking. But I've just invested quite a lot of time in this particular formulation now.
There's another question from Shailesh.
Simon, maybe this is a question related to what Lucas asked. So if you look at the n equals 2 calculation, you said that there is no phase transition. But if I keep if I keep cranking up the coupling, is it true that there's no phase transition all the way to infinite coupling, or you just stop somewhere and you don't know what's going on?
I don't know is the answer. I'll be completely honest with you. I started off looking at n equals 2, gave it quite a lot of attention because it runs with hybrid Monte Carlo. It's very simple code. I didn't see any evidence for phase transition, so then I wrote an RHMC code and started looking at n equals 1. And then I didn't see a phase transition, and then I realized I really had to go to very large LS to see it. It's been quite a painful road. So I cannot exclude that if I went back and gave the same amount of attention to n equals 2, then there wouldn't be a signal. It would be smaller and harder to see. So it's very hard to prove a negative, you know, as I'm sure you'd agree. So perhaps I'm being a little bit, you know, cheeky by claiming that the critical number of flavors is smaller than 2. But I'm certain that the critical number of flavors is bigger than 1.
Okay, great, thanks.
Okay, I think I don't see any further urgent questions, so let's thank Simon again.